Woo!
Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
And I'm pumped on this Tuesday because we have a hot date.
We have a hot date? What do you mean by that?
Well, one, this podcast.
Okay.
Always a weekly hot date. But then we're going to the running shoe store tonight. And I'm already excited.
I'm so excited for the running shoe store. As you know, I have a little bit of a problem. Like, my ultimate dream in the world would be to have one of those like supermarket showdowns where I get to have a bag and just get to go fill it up in the running shoe store. So what are we going for this evening?
Actually, I need a pack. We're not even going for shoes. I have kind of like a fast pack and it has the puniest little bottles. I feel like they're like shot glasses of bottles, 250 milliliters. And now that I'm stepping up to like bigger races, I need freaking big drinks. I need like the Franzia wine box equivalents of drinking capabilities.
You need to upgrade those implants?
They do feel like implants when you're running.
I've heard people say that when they're getting implants or whatever, whether it's for health condition or aesthetics or whatever, you know, totally uplift any personal decision anyone makes, but they'll bring out like a smorgasbord of options to them.
Really?
Like 16 different options of shapes, sizes, quantities, types. It's really interesting to think about. Like they're, you know, we're talking about running shoe store. It's like you have all these different options. There's also a boob store.
Yeah. You should be required to like stick them in a hydration vest first and run uphill and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to go because we're also going to get some shoes to try. We've piloted on Patreon, like a Q&A thing where we're trying to ask listeners for shoes that we need to review. And so we have a few options. I'm going to go see what we can get. So very excited about that
too. What is your go-to option? What are you thinking of?
I'm thinking the La Sportiva Prodigio.
Oh, interesting. I've heard people say they actually remind them a lot of Speed Goat Evos.
Exactly.
And they're like, I'm like, they know that is like, there's not, what's the opposite of a safe word? A hype word. That is, the Speed Goat Evos are my hype word.
You know the way into my pants. Yeah. You just mentioned the long discontinued Speed Goat Evo and I'll be like, I'm in. I'll have it. Absolutely. I'll vote for any candidate that puts that as their main platform in 2028. It's like, that is my candidate.
Actually, I had a Strava title yesterday for my long run that was, she wears high heels, I wear Speed Goat Evos off of Taylor Swift. And I was so proud of it.
Wears high heels, I wear Evos.
She's cheer captain and I drink flat Cokes.
doesn't
quite work. I'm pretty far from Taylor Swift.
No, Megan, you're exactly like Taylor Swift. What are the differences between you and Taylor Swift? I can't think of a single one.
Many, many differences. But you know what? I actually, for the first time in my life, kind of want to be her.
Yeah. So let's transition right into that before we get into the episode. You've gone on a Taylor Swift kick to the point that I'm a little bit concerned. So
you're concerned?
Yeah, Megan, I don't want you to be one of them.
No, I am not. Okay, so I was in like the fifth percentile of Taylor Swift for the longest time.
You liked her.
I love her stuff. I mean, she's got great music.
Yeah.
I just don't think I ever like fully explored the depths of her like soul and her music and like kind of what it embodies, because we started watching the Disney. So Disney did like a whole like show essentially on her Eras tour.
Yeah. So just the movie that came out went on to Disney Plus.
Okay. And it was, we started watching it with Leo and it was so good. And I kind of had this moment where I'm embarrassed to say, but now I understand.
Now you understand.
I was like, why would people pay thousands of dollars to go see Taylor Swift? Like, imagine how many shoes, imagine how many Speed Goat Evos you could get for thousands of dollars. You could just like scrape eBay and fly yourself to France, buy a pair of Speed Goat Evos and come back. But you know what? I might spend it on Taylor Swift now.
Well, now if they required a kidney, you would be there with scissors, just going into your own body.
Actually,
for that.
I don't know about a kidney. That has ultra consequences.
Still, Megan, the amount that you're into Taylor Swift kind of scares me.
Okay, no. I mean, I'm into Taylor Swift. I think I've just bumped up from like the fifth percentile to like the 25th percentile. I mean, the 100th percentile of Taylor Swift might actually be a little scary.
Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of weird, the obsession with Taylor Swift's like life.
Okay, I kind of get it now.
But her life, I understand the music idea. Like, if you really like someone's music, great. But the mythologizing of an individual to me is a little bit weird. Like, there's all of these conspiracies online. One is called Gaylor, where Taylor Swift has secretly been gay this whole time.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be interesting?
It'd be awesome. Yeah. But why are people treating Taylor Swift like she's Game of Thrones?
Well, isn't it fun to live and like exist in a fantasy world outside of the real world? Where you can just like ascribe different rules and parameters and dreamlands to that state. And I feel like that's what people are doing with Taylor Swift.
But there's real fantasy out there. We don't need a fantasy projected onto a real human.
Oh, but it's more fun when it's fantasy and you can see it on Disney. Yeah. And they make great music. And you can like, I don't know, paraphrase Speed Goat Evos in there too.
Oh, Megan, I'm a dude. I'm into professional wrestling and Dune. And you're into Taylor Swift. So it's perfect.
I know. Okay, I'm 25% into Taylor Swift.
Okay.
I'm still maintaining like myself. of like my self-identity, myself of like my sense of self-integrity, all that stuff.
You're partially erect for Taylor Swift.
Okay. Actually, no, I'm fully erect for Taylor Swift. Those nipples are, they're feeling the hydration pack status and they're like, Taylor Swift.
3 feet off your body. All right, we have the best episode for you. Quick roadmap. We're going to talk about Megan's first intentional double workout, building off an episode a couple weeks ago. Then the saddest athletic story of my life. You're all going to be heartbroken to hear, but everything's okay. Talk about the uphill treadmill from a question from a listener, a new durability study, a wild study on vibration during intervals.
Which is not what you expect.
Not what you expect, but it blew my mind. Maybe a question on improving climbing, maybe a multivitamin study, and then news and fun things, including a quote from Lance Armstrong that was really interesting, athlete contract thoughts, hot takes, so much more. This one is jam-packed.
Okay, I'm also not leaving this podcast recording studio, which is our bedroom, until we talk about all of our sacks.
Okay.
So he's in news and fun things, and I refuse to leave until we've talked about him.
Okay, so Oliver Sacks will be there before hot takes.
Yes, and we have a very tangential way of getting to Oliver Sacks, which I think shows our brain state at times.
Interestingly, so Oliver Sacks is a
late neuroscientist. He's written some really, who actually got me his book when we were first dating.
Yeah,
Musicophilia was actually the first book you ever bought for me.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
You didn't realize that?
Well, interestingly today, our way in to talk about Oliver Sacks is via Sacks, yeah. But the physical type. So
the gonads of Sacks.
Yes, you'll see. Okay, so first, let's talk about your double workout. So last Wednesday in the morning, you did 12 by 1 minute hills, like a harder session. And then the afternoon, you did your first intentional session where it was a progression on the uphill treadmill, like we talked about a couple weeks ago. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I love that you're calling this like an intentional double workout because in my prior history as a royal shithead, I would sometimes go out and do doubles far too hard.
Yeah.
And so I kind of accidentally be having double workouts. But I feel like over the last like 8 years, we've taken a much more intentional approach in my training.
Yeah.
And I think it was my first traditional, like we actually executed this double workout and it was super fun.
I think the dichotomy between your past training and your current training is pretty interesting because in the old days, we would call them Megan runs. You would go out and run pretty hard all the time. But I do think you were so aerobically efficient that a lot more of those runs were in Z2 or Z3 in a five zone model than you think in retrospect. And as a result, like you're spending a ton of time at Z2. So even though you trained like in your words, a shithead, I think that it served you well at that time in your career.
I mean, I think to be fair, I was a mitochondrially efficient shithead.
Yes.
But yeah. I do think that there was properties in which like that was not the best thing for my long-term progression. And I've taken a much better approach. But it was interesting. So on Wednesday, I had this double workout approach. It was VO2 hills in the morning, which VO2 hills are certainly a window into pain.
Yeah.
Like there's a very different feeling of doing something like 12 by 1 minute hills versus a more lactate controlled threshold type of workout.
Yeah.
And then I came home, I had been on a bunch of calls, and then 30 minutes before I was about to go do my tread hill double, you informed me it was also in a workout.
Yeah. Well, I mean, didn't want you to get too scared by it before, because I think often these types of things feel much more daunting than they are when you get on it. And so I got to go down and see you. You absolutely crushed it. You progressed, I think, faster than you thought you were going to be able to.
Well, when you told me the parameters of the workout, there was this little, like, I don't know, scaredy cat alarm going off in my brain. I was like, Megan, can you actually hit these splits? And I was proud of myself because I went downstairs and I was like, you know, it actually truly doesn't matter if I hit the splits, just getting down there and trying. And then it felt better than I thought it would. And it was actually one of those reflections where having a coach is sometimes so powerful because I wouldn't have done that workout without your guidance and without you kind of helping me determine the splits. And it pushed me further than I probably would have even pushed myself.
Yeah. It's tough though, because I almost feel like in threshold sessions, it's really easy to get ahead of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But especially when you're dealing with overall life stress. So you were coming back from Lululemon Further, as we talked about last week, you had a lot of work going on. And it might have been that we pushed you just a little bit too far. Because even though it was a great day, you came out of it feeling good from my perspective. This weekend, you hit a little bit of a life wall. Are you open to telling listeners about that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So this weekend, I had 20 miles on the calendar on Saturday. And I feel like this last week, we had a week where I would call it, we just had a lot of error bars in life.
Yes.
You know, like I feel like we're kind of maximizing our potential with the amount of life that we can fit in and also train at the same time.
Yeah.
But then it was like, I don't know, we had like mild calamity after mild calamity.
Followed by a huge snowstorm here in Boulder.
So we didn't have childcare. Leo spent like all of one night awake crying, like just a lot had been going on.
Yeah.
And I got up on Saturday and going out and running 20 miles after these series of minor calamities felt like a lot. Yeah. And so I actually just didn't do it.
Yeah, you did nothing.
I did nothing. And it was a very restorative day. Maybe not the best thing in terms of like my long-term canyons progression, but I do feel like there is an element as a parent, kind of, I've been working a number of jobs that sometimes you just have to be comfortable being flexible.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to mention that like you feel like a shithead in those moments.
Oh yeah.
But that's the ultimate most important thing you can do in an athletic journey. And so if you're ever out there and you have those low motivation days, if they persist, pay attention to it. Dial back the training, take a zero on your long run day and don't make it up. Like, I think that's the coolest thing of all. You didn't make it up. You went out there and had a good run on Sunday and let that kind of get sponged out of your system, and you crushed it.
Oh, it was fun. On Sunday, I went out and I listened to Taylor Swift. It's so fun to like put on the Eras Tour and just put it on shuffle. And it was one of those runs. I feel like sometimes when you come back and you do have, like for me, it kind of felt like a mental mechanical. Like I went out on the bike and my brain broke down a little bit. And then on Sunday, when things were feeling good, my brain was working. I also appreciated it so much and it was so fun to be out there. And so I do think there's almost this opportunity of like the resurgence after having to be flexible and take a day off and you just appreciate it.
I like it. And when you're pushing training at the limits, when you're doing things like double workouts and all of the things we talk about on here, you got to listen to your body because none of this unfolds in an Excel chart. Mm-hmm. Like that would make it so much more simple if we could understand training and stimulus and adaptation via numbers. But in reality, there's 10,000 different arrow bars on this flow chart. And for whatever reason, yours added up to being just absolutely fucking wrecked.
And actually, to talk about a visual, on Instagram, I actually saw someone put together, they put like essentially a bunch of lines, each representing training days and how that looks as the conglomeration of a training block. And then on the next like paragraph, there was lines missing and you literally couldn't tell the difference visually between the two.
Yeah.
And the body is obviously different physiologically. You don't want to miss a lot of key training sessions, but like missing one or two in the context of a general training block, totally okay.
Especially because it unfolds over years. You know, so many bricks in the wall. I mean, think about my journey here. So I've had multiple knee issues this winter. Maybe this is the progression to becoming a geriatric athlete.
I don't think so. Do you know why I think it is?
Why?
I think it's connected to the fact that you're feeling really good right now, but that you got back into strength training.
Maybe.
Yeah. or it's like the combination of strength training and kind of being, you've booped your knees a few times.
I've booped my knees, but then the other one, like, I don't even know where it came from.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, if I thought of that in an academic way, in a coach's way, in a coach that's relying on the numbers sort of way, I'd look at my training volume this winter and think that athlete is not fully ready. And then the weirdest thing has happened since I've come back from these layoffs where I've biked a good bit and I've done a ton of uphill treadmill that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. My numbers are better than ever. Like yesterday, I did 18 miles here on the back roads of Boulder with, you know, just moderately hilly kind of dirt type roads.
Also, our roads right now, because of our snowstorm, it's like running through a cheese grater or something. Like it's pretty washboardy.
At 144 heart rate, faster than I ever have. Like, and it's kind of interesting to think about how sometimes I think what we consider empty spaces are actually adaptation spaces to the long-term type of stress that we're not aware of. And so, you know, you taking that zero, I think it's a lot more, less about the acute stress that it could be the double workout, but I think it's much more about, for whatever reason, your body was adding up. And if you tried to add another brick to the wall, you would have Jenga'd straight to the ground.
Falling all to the ground. But as we talk about this now, it's like looking back on the empty space, I always feel like is a lot easier than existing within the empty space.
Yeah.
And I feel like for full picture, what I actually looked like on Saturday, it's very different than this reflection. Like,
I wasn't pushing you to say this. I just wanted you to say you took a zero.
Oh, you know, it's like sometimes you take a zero, you lie on the couch, you have some tears.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not beautiful, but you know what? As you look back on it, you're like, I'm proud of myself. But like, I feel like actually existing within the empty space.
Yeah.
Is a lot easier said than done.
Now it's funny.
It is. It's actually extremely funny.
You don't thrive when you don't meet your expectations.
I don't. And I've gotten progressively better at it.
True.
But what better looks like is still a royal shit show. Yeah. It's kind of embarrassing.
I think everyone thinks you just have everything together.
No.
If they listen to the podcast, they know.
I mean, on most weeks, I have things together. There are some weeks that are a little bit of a nightmare.
Yeah.
How would you describe it?
I would describe it as I went upstairs to work to be away from whatever was happening after I told you I loved you. And then
peaced out.
I did. And then I come back down. This is when Leo was napping and you're reading. and all I see is you're reading and sobbing at the same time, and you weren't sobbing at the book.
Actually, to be fair, it was a sad book.
Okay.
The ending was sad. So it was building. It was stacking.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you just need to go over into a corner and sob to yourself. And when that happens, I'm just like, all right, one of those days.
But then I felt better.
Yeah.
And then it made Sunday so much more special. So the MD space had some tears.
And training's all about, you know, and being an athlete is all about pushing your limits and getting to experience things that you might not experience otherwise. So yeah, like think about what else in life would make you that sad.
Oh yeah, but that's the cool thing is it's a gift to love something so much that you sit on the couch crying, reading a book on a beautiful Saturday because it didn't happen.
But that's what I mean. Like, you know, athletics making you that sad, fine. You'll come back the next day or eventually it'll work out, right? It's not life and death. Other things that make you that sad are life and death. Things like, you know, your heart blowing up or whatever has happened to you in the past. So I think it's the coolest thing about athletics is you get to experience life kind of in a cocoon where it matters so much, but it also doesn't.
Yeah. But I really, when you're existing in the empty space, it truly matters a lot.
And that's when you listen to the Taylor Swift slow songs.
That's so true.
Where she talks about how sad things are. And then afterward, shake it off. Okay. We also wanted to mention this amazing experience we had on Friday, which is we got to visit the headquarters of The Feed.
It was so fun. We went on a field trip, essentially.
It was totally a field trip.
Leo had a snow day. We didn't have childcare. So we brought him with us.
Yeah.
And it was such a blast getting to see their headquarters and seeing how they operate. And like, oh, I was so excited. Actually, talk about a game show.
Yeah.
I wanted to run through. So we got to see the warehouse where they have all of their products. I really wanted to go through and do a 60-second challenge and just grab as much stuff as possible. And they should host that in their facility.
Ketones. They're expensive.
Do you think that's what it would be? They're small though. It'd probably be hard to like,
oh, if you just have one bag.
Yeah.
You'd probably want one of the like expensive supplements.
That's true.
Or something like that. Or Norbitech boots.
That's true. Yeah. Just go straight for the goods.
Yeah.
Actually, I've been having ketones post-exercise.
Yeah.
And I've been doing them in the shower. And I feel like now my shower beer has evolved into shower ketones.
I've seen them in the shower. What are you doing? Why?
It's my shower beer equivalent. I don't drink anymore, but I do have ketones.
Actually, maybe that's a good way to talk about this promo. So we talked on here about the science of post-exercise ketones. A few months ago. Since then, we've gotten to do lots of little anecdotal pilot studies with athletes where we have blood work before, some blood work after, and performance data after. Mm-hmm. The things we have seen back up some of the theoretical ideas that we presented on that episode. So The Feed is the best place to get them. We just use the ketone IQ. So go to thefeed.com/swap. There you get you're on our team page. You just click claim reward and you get $80 in credit, just like cash. It's so good. And then you can buy ketones for post-exercise. What we're seeing is that it increases red blood cells, improves endurance, but only post-exercise. This isn't a fuel source. And there's a great place to get them.
Also, the caveat too is we still don't really know the mechanisms through which they work. And so it is like a slightly scary field to wander into. And so I think just be cautious, however you use ketones, just to know there isn't like great long-term research on it. But you know, sometimes you got to be a guinea pig.
I mean, I wouldn't call it a scary field. Maybe it's like you're wearing a blindfold going into a field pantsless, but then everything around you is really soft and warm. So no chainsaws anywhere to be
found. That sounds very creepy.
So thefeed.com/stuff. And we got a really great email from a listener that we wanted to read. Such great news on the sponsorship. To anyone who hasn't dealt with The Feed or maybe wants a tip about how awesome they are, I have a weird endocrine disorder that results in calcium deficiency. I texted them a collection of obscure parameters I was looking for in a protein powder. I just couldn't face sorting through all the nutrition labels on my own. They got back to me in less than 24 hours with a great suggestion and 3 pages of evidence. They really know their stuff, and apparently they are happy to assist with this kind of comparison shopping. I do not, however, want them to give me any information about how much I've spent there in the last year. Do not need to know.
I would love to know how much we spent there in the last year. It's probably pretty wild.
Yeah.
Okay, but here was my reflection. So we went there, and you are such a great barista with like hydration mixes and drinks, and they had a whole bunch of them there that you could play with.
Oh my God.
And now that's what I'm trying to recreate in our house is I feel like I have this like panic hydration mindset where come 5 or 6 p.m., I reflect back on the day and I'm like, fuck, I think I'm dehydrated.
Yeah.
So I drink a lot and then I'm peeing all night. But I think the like fun hydration products are going to change this reality for me.
It's going to be game changing. I'm so excited. This is such a good deal. Free cash if you go to our site there. Okay. Now, finally, the saddest story athletically I have ever heard.
Were you crying on a couch reading a book?
It got close, Megan.
It did get close, actually. And you know what? I vacated the room.
Yes.
Yeah. I like hid in the laundry room after this experience happened. And so I feel like we both have parallel stories this week.
So Thursday. it's a big snowstorm here. We're not going to have childcare. Athletics tough to come by. But I'm able to get onto the bike and I go downstairs and I do a Zwift race. So I'm racing on the bike and it's up the big mountain there. There's 22 switchbacks on this mountain.
And it counts them down for you too, which is actually a really fun experience.
And, you know, I've been building back from all these things and I was doing my second most power output ever on this climb. And I was competing for the win in this race, ready to do the final sprint. When before the final switchback, right when I was ready to unleash, the power went out and the video game died. And I was probably just more heartbroken than I've ever been.
I could hear you screaming downstairs. It was so sad. And then you came upstairs and it was the first time I've actually ever seen you exist in a state of like frustration, true frustration and sadness to the point that I left the room.
Yeah.
That almost never happens with you.
It points out what we said about athletics mattering and not. Right?
That's true. Like,
obviously this video game doesn't matter. And my power output on this climb doesn't matter. But in the moment when I get in that mindset,
you were so furious.
It matters so much.
Actually, it was sexy. I feel like you very rarely express fury and anger and like deep rage. And
sexy.
It was, yeah, your testosterone probably went up like 200 points.
If I punched a wall, would that make you love me more?
Maybe. Maybe if it had to do with Zwift and climbing.
Like I said, professional wrestling and Dune. That's what I'm into now. So wanted to share that. We've probably all had something like that happen before. And I actually have a few more hot takes. Are these, should I give these or should I save these for the future?
Oh, you should definitely. We should actually, we need to have a movement to move hot takes up in the episode.
Okay. So a few of them. First, you mentioned peeing at night.
Yes.
I have a new hot take.
What?
Don't pee at night.
So what do you do with it? Does it just like seep out all around you?
It just comes back into your body. Yeah. I don't know. So I used to always struggle. If you're one of those people out there that wakes up at 3 a.m., pees, and then has trouble going back to sleep, that was me.
Yeah, well, you would do that. And then I would have trouble going back to sleep because you would wake me up.
Yeah. And so what I did is I just decided, I took a very hot shower before bed. So I sweat a little bit and then decided that when I have that feeling, I just ignore it. And even though it's really hard to hold it right at first, I do sleep better having to pee than I do when I get up to pee. So I would say pay attention to it. Obviously, that comes from a place of prostate privilege.
Yeah, I was going to say pelvic floor privilege.
Yeah.
I've actually tried this sometimes on runs because so often for me, I have this spot where I pee on all of my runs, which is actually just like in the wide open middle of the road and I just let it loose. But sometimes if I'm like really pushing, I run past that spot and there's like something about my brain has the Pavlov's dogs association and is like, I must pee now. But you know what? If you work through it, your body does kind of absorb it.
Pavlov's pelvic floor.
Yeah.
Okay. Number two is we talk a lot about doubles on here. New thing. Do not shower after your first session. Because if you shower after your first session, it's so much harder. This is my big theory. My big unified theory is that the hardest part of exercise is the part where you start getting dirty. And then once
the hardest part? I love getting dirty.
But my theory is that the brain knows that I'm clean and it doesn't want to get dirty. Yeah. And then it does.
Since when have you cared this much about cleanliness?
Care. It's all in the back of your brain. It's some part of the deep brain.
The primal elements of the brain?
Yeah. I'm talking about the same part of the brain we share with sharks.
It's awesome. So, well, sharks are clean all the time.
No doubles.
Wait, you think sharks are clean? They're existing in the ocean.
True. Okay, touche. Maybe I don't. And then the final thing is I listened back to last week's episode. The number of times I don't agree with myself of things I said just that morning.
Actually, you came in and you listened back and you're like, I think I disagreed with myself 6 times.
Yeah. So that might even apply to the things I just mentioned.
Sharks.
No, sharks are fucking dirty.
Yeah.
So dirty. Dirty like Christina Aguilera was dirty back in the Xtina days.
Actually, speaking of that though, not Christina, but the fact of like disagreeing with yourself. I think you should actually go into, we had this like long conversation about Kara Swisher, who we love.
Yeah.
And you said something, this was like right before I was falling asleep at night and it made me sleep 10 hours. I was so content and peaceful with what you said that it was amazing. So why don't you like, can you reiterate that?
Okay. So Kara Swisher's amazing book, Burn Book, if you like tech and her personal journey, it's really, really good. It was essentially a quote that amounted to this. Talking about one of the people she was interviewing and covering in tech journalism. I don't need you to like me. I need people who love me to like me.
Which I feel like people who love you should probably be confined to like a little post-it note.
No, I mean, I think it's fine to have a big group of people that love you.
Oh yeah, but like you could write small on a post-it note.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking like 20 people on a post-it note.
I mean, yes, yeah. I think it's just important to keep that perspective.
Well, I feel like I am a chronic people pleaser.
Yeah.
And so when you talk about like disagreeing with yourself, I feel like I actually don't disagree with myself enough when I go back and listen to the podcast. And it's because there's an element of me that like doesn't want to, I mean, I like stirring up the shit or like seeing shit stirred up, but I don't feel like I like the aftermath of it. And so I don't do it enough.
Well, we're going to go for more controversial takes from you.
From me.
That's our goal. Yeah, I give enough.
I need to catch up.
I give enough. We get so many messages about like people not agreeing with me, but yeah. We don't get any about you.
We get some about me.
I don't get them. Do you get them?
No, I just assume you didn't tell me.
No, it's time to step up your game.
I know. I need to pull more Kara Swisher out of me and stop the people pleasing.
And like you do on Patreon. So patreon.com/swap, SWAP. There we answer tons of questions on bonus podcasts. I did another solo episode last week.
I know. We didn't have childcare. We had to spend to the feed. How was it?
It was great.
Yeah.
I'm getting better.
Yeah. I think you're probably really good.
I'm improving. Yeah. People like it.
Yeah. They're like, Megan, stay away.
And we also, or I also, gave our Chuckanut 50K fantasy picks before the race, which all three of the athletes I mentioned ended up being on the podium.
Yeah. It's insider trading.
Yeah.
I feel like if you want to do well in the fantasy league, is that even okay to do? I guess there's like no money involved.
Totally fine.
Yeah. Well, I guess they do pay us money. So yeah. Go listen to Patreon and I feel like you're going to crush the fantasy.
Patreon.com/swap.
Actually, Chuckanut was a great race.
Yeah. That was amazing. Like another one of those races where I think, again, you know, a lot of the training principles we talk about are like take it or leave it. Different things work for everyone, but it's kind of fun to see it in action at a race like Chuckanut, where swap athletes went 1, 2, 3 for women. So Claire, Jade, and then Priscilla, and then Matt was second for men. And, you know, it's just really cool to like have those moments of reflection.
What's also a fun reflection too is I do feel like that's a very much a running economy based course.
Yeah.
So the first 6 miles of the course are flat. Then it goes into kind of this gnarly technical, like trail element part of it. And then it ends with the same 6, 7 miles on flat ground. And I actually love that type of course because I feel like you have to be a well-rounded, fast trail runner to excel. Yeah. And it's kind of fun to think about like what training philosophy you use to excel at a type of race like that.
Yeah. And I think
it's just being a good runner.
And that's what it is for everything.
Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not like this course design is something special in terms of training theory, but I feel like it does put, I feel like there's less variables. And so it does like reward training theory versus like a 100 mile race where just a lot can happen.
You need to be super economical.
Yes, exactly.
That should be. Otherwise you're going to be going too hard at first for any of the other variables to take over. Okay. So let's get to a question to start the training part of the discussion. This is called Hello Treadhill Monsters. And this is from Patreon. We actually answered it there too. But a lot of people said that they wanted to hear it on the main podcast. Here's the question. I'm super impressed that people can run 15% grade for 30 to 45 minutes, but that is not me. It's all I can do to go 3 miles per hour at 15% for 5 minutes. I want to get better at my treadhilling, but I wonder how best to progress. Is it better to go faster at low inclines or slower at steeper inclines? Is it better to go a longer time running at an incline I can sustain, or just do faster bursts of shorter, steeper intervals that max me out? Some combination of all of these? Perhaps it would be okay to do a beginner's guide to treadhilling.
Oh, I love this. And I think you answered this on the Patreon episode this week, but I was not there.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear what you said.
I know. We should see how our thoughts align. This is like sprinkling in a little pressure. I think my thought would be let's maximize efficiency before maximizing grade.
Yeah.
And so I think finding a really efficient pace, I would say like for climbing something like 4 miles an hour, I would consider to be like a base efficiency pace. And then so like if it's 4 miles an hour at 8%, amazing. And then like gradually start increasing the incline by like 1 or 2%. As you start feeling more comfortable.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. It's exactly what I said, because 4 miles an hour is the general switch where hiking and running trade off. There's some good studies on this. It's maybe a little bit over 4, but 4 is a convenient round number to choose. And so since what we're trying to build is that mechanical output to improve running while getting some of the reduced impact and aerobic benefits of climbing, 4% is a great way to do it. For some athletes, that might be 3% at first, and you might have to mix in walking intervals. But over time, I think you'll notice that you can start to increase. And then what you do is instead of saying, I have to sustain this for the whole 30 minutes, pulse up to 4 miles an hour and 10%, or then eventually 4 miles an hour and 15% for a minute or two at a time.
Which is actually a really fun way to pass the time. Like it makes it feel like a fun interval workout.
Yeah. And then over time, hopefully you can just raise the grade overall. And eventually you might be doing, you know, 4 miles an hour and 15% grade, and you'll see massive progress across the board, like we talk about. So, you know, with all of our principles, message if you find that it doesn't apply to your journey, because basically, I think it should for most of what we talk about. Maybe not the double hard workouts, but at least something like this should apply to everybody.
Also, 4 miles per hour can feel totally different on different treadmill contexts too. Yes. And so it's also possible that your treadmill, like ours, is royally fucked up. And so like, don't get down on yourself if you're not hitting certain paces, because it's probably widely variable.
Calibration's so different.
It's so wild. Also, you are a master at like messing up the calibration. Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I don't know, Megan. I think that at some level, subconsciously, I just want things to be harder than they are.
Yeah, you just like wear the treadmill down over time.
No, that's it. Every treadmill I've ever had, when I actually measure it, ends up being miscalibrated. Maybe that's just every treadmill, or maybe it's something I do. I don't know exactly what's happening, but it's a nightmare.
Well, how are you measuring it?
Well, a couple different ways. So for the actual treadmill belt, you just mark the side of the treadmill, then you can do easy calculations. But then for the grade of the treadmill, on your phone, they just have bubble levels and you can measure the exact gradient of the different things. So ours is off by about 2% grade.
Actually, ours is up off about by a 2% grade, but also off in the pace too. Yes. Which I actually kind of love. It's like, there's no reason to judge data while you're down there because it's not even right data to begin with.
Nordic Track. They are the worst. Nordic Track, give us a better treadmill.
I know.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, actually, they're going to need to give us a treadmill. We're going to have like a subscription service to treadmills. We're going to need a new one every 6 months, given how often you break them.
Maybe the feed will be selling treadmills soon.
Oh, they should.
That'd be cool.
I know. They sell a lot of stuff.
They sell a lot of recovery gear too, if you're into it. So yeah, treadmills, everybody's friend. Even if 15% isn't for you, 3% could be. And work into that. You can work in walking intervals, but then also increase it and bet on yourself. I think one of the hard things about uphill treadmill in particular is that there is no end. Mm-hmm. So sometimes athletes just get a little bit in their head and think that their body is incapable of what it actually is. And so last week we talked about the Lululemon Further event, changing perceptions of what people can do. Mm-hmm. I think the treadmill is a great time to change your own perception and work on it. It's like, touch the stove and see what happens. When do you actually need to step off? I think it's probably a little bit farther than most think.
I also think too, it's more psychologically daunting than it is physiologically daunting. So like for me on Wednesday, I did VO2 hills in the morning and then those were hard.
Yeah.
Like I saw, actually, as Mike Smith says, I saw my ancestors in that workout and I was like, damn, that was hard.
Deacons, right? So it was your maiden name. So your ancestors probably at least have some Irish. Yesterday, we're recording this on Monday, was St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah,
so
I know.
Pinch you.
I know. I poured one out for them.
Yeah.
Out of my like little hydration flask. But then I feel like when I did the uphill treadmill, the hills on that compared to VO2 hills, it's like your body just works into it. Like the treadmill itself is doing a lot of the work for you. And it felt way easier to sustain like 175 heart rate for me than it did on VO2 hills.
Definitely. Okay, let's get on to the first study of today, which just came out in the European Journal of Sports Science. It's called "The Intensity Rather Than the Quantity of Prior Work Determines the Subsequent Downward Shift in the Power Duration Relationship in Professional Cyclists." So this is a great one because it touches on what we love, fatigue resistance / durability. After you do a certain amount of work, how does your power output, your pace, whatever you want to call it, decay? Because that's what ends up determining performance in long races. So this is the number one metric. It's why when any study comes out, we want to bring it to you.
And they did it in cyclists, which I feel like there's so much conversation surrounding durability in cyclists.
Yeah.
And I'm like, bring on the trail runners. Like,
yeah, why isn't it as much in running, do you think?
Well, I feel like in cycling, it's so easy to measure.
Sure.
Like
power
everything,
meters, yeah.
Everything is done in power meters. There's like very direct ways to look at things. And so it kind of makes sense. Also too, I feel like there's like, because maybe of like the Pro Peloton and UCI, it feels like there's a lot more like teams use the research a lot more.
No,
maybe
it's
because it's much more of like a scientific based, like because it's almost like a pure physics based sport.
Yeah.
It makes sense that like the researcher is almost like a more direct, it's more generalizable essentially to what actually gets used.
Yeah. I mean, some of these teams, they don't look at people's power profiles in a direct sense of like how much power can this person put out for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They look at these fatigue resistance rates. And then that's how they determine who they give contracts to, which is really scary. And maybe we're happy that doesn't come to running.
Oh, it's a great thing. It doesn't come to running because it's like if running were just numbers, I mean, I love numbers. I'm partial to numbers, but it would be boring. Like it loses like the storytelling essence. And I think running is much more an art than a science. And cycling, honestly, sadly enough, is truly a physics science.
It is a little bit to a certain extent.
Yeah, there's some duende in it.
There's duende. In cycling, what it's called? Ciclismo.
Oh, I like that.
It's like a certain je ne sais quoi. It's mixing languages, but you get the idea. So what this study did that was really novel is that many studies involve a certain amount of work. Like I said, 2,000 kilojoules, 3,000 kilojoules. What this one did is it differentiated between the intensity of that work. So it took 14 professional cyclists with an average critical power of 5.3 watts per kilogram.
So these are strong cyclists.
Strong athletes.
Yes, yeah.
And then it did 3 power profile tests that all involved a 15-second all-out session, 3 minutes all-out, and 12 minutes all-out. So the first one was in a fresh state, the type of thing is just power profile. The second was in a low intensity state. So they were fatigued with 2000 kilojoules of work at 70% of critical power, very sustainable for these athletes. And then the third was in a high intensity state. They were fatigued with a 5x8 minute protocol at 105 to 110% of critical power, but less work overall. So it wasn't a hugely fatiguing session in terms of total kilojoules, but it was a pretty hard session in terms of the actual workout.
Karen, I do think it's helpful to kind of contextualize what critical power is.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, we might need like a 60-minute podcast episode because it is hotly debated. There have been some like Twitter debates and like lots of stuff, but functionally critical power is slightly faster or slightly higher intensity than FTP. Yeah. And FTP, functional threshold power, is the amount of watts an athlete can put out per hour.
Yeah.
And then so critical power is slightly below that.
Sometimes.
And when I say slightly, it's hotly debated. Yeah. Maybe. Or,
you nailed it. We just don't want to wander into the cycling critical power fields.
Yes.
Because every single time I see a study on critical power, going into the theoretical basis of it and maximal lactate steady state in cyclists, I'm just like, nope, not for me. I don't need to be an expert on that sport particularly. I want to be an expert on the principles.
Okay. If you had a cyclist, if you had to put, I'm going to put you on the spot.
No, you're
refusing.
Oh, great. That's my controversial take.
Okay.
Nope.
My controversial take, you know what? I'll wade into it because I need to do that a little bit more. I'll pull Kara Swisher out of me. I would say it's like something you could hold for like 40 to 45 minutes, critical power.
Varies.
Yes.
Varies. It depends.
There's nuance. But like sometimes I feel like saying there's nuance is just a cop out to giving an answer that you can like wiggle room off of.
I think it helps to just think threshold.
Yes.
And for the purposes of this discussion.
Okay. But so when you get back to the workouts, if you think 5x8 minutes at 105 to 110% of critical power, that's actually a substantial amount of power that these athletes are putting out.
It's a hard session, yeah.
It's also a novel workout too. So it's not like this type of workout, like 5x8 minutes at 110% of critical power. It's something that's like repeated across the methodology in cycling research.
Yeah.
And so I do think that becomes relevant because it's like, they're like, oh, let's just come up with a workout and have cyclists do this.
A hard threshold session.
Yeah.
Well, how is this that different from 2x20 minutes or 2x15 minutes or all the other
things? The lactate profile is probably very similar.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah. So, I mean, I think basically it's a session that they can do that they're not going to fail on, but does exhaust them, but not fully exhaust them, which is relevant for what we talk about next. So, what changed in the power profile? So, first, the 15 second power was lower in the high intensity group. So, it wasn't just about doing the amount of work.
So, after they did the high intensity training session, this five by eight minutes, they came back and their ability to put out 15 seconds of power compared to fresh was lower.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. And then the next one's a little bit of a statistical distinction without a difference, I think. So the 3 minute power dropped from the fresh session to the high intensity session. So afterward, but not from the fresh to the low. They didn't say anything about from the low, the high. So my guess is that the difference was insignificant there, but they anchored it in the fresh. And so 3 minute power for all intents and purposes dropped as well. But then interestingly, the 12-minute power was not statistically different between the low group and the high group. So I think what we're seeing there is a new idea of how these power profiles might change over time, which is your maximal ability to call on glycolysis, like top-end glycolysis for 15 seconds in 3 minutes and things like that decreases. And probably over time with longer events and things like that, that would decrease even more and start affecting the 12-minute. But it's more about how this affects glycolysis than like the fat oxidation end of the curve, which is relevant for trail and ultra runners too, because it's not just about how long you've gone, how many miles you've gone. It's about the distribution of that intensity. Like you don't want to go just a little bit too hard because that's going to cause this like fatigue resistance metric, which might be connected to glycolysis, to fatigue more rapidly, which will cause some issues later.
And I actually think you're getting almost exactly into what I was about to wade into, is that pacing matters so much in trail efforts. And I think this study proves exactly that, is that if you spend a lot of time significantly exceeding threshold in longer races, like it's burning a lot of matches in terms of like your ability to put out power later on. And I do think it's really important to think about how you're expending your energy as a trail runner. Granted, I guess it's a little bit different because it's not like at the end of a trail race, you're going to be putting out like a 3 minute max effort. But I do think like, I think these cyclists, you know, their critical power is an average of 5.3 watts per kilogram. I imagine if we applied this to more of a population-based level of like all types of cyclists, we would start to see changes in power at like the 12-minute, the 20-minute, the 30-minute level too.
And when the power curve shifts like that, everything's going to be affected. Even if we don't measure it right now, like once you start to see any change in the power curve, including top end, you'll start to see issues throughout. And so a good example is the Chuckanut 50K that we talked about. On all my previous calls with athletes, the main thing I said is that first 10K, which is on essentially a bridle path, it's not it does have some climbing. It's not purely flat. Is 30 seconds there is going to ruin your race. Mm-hmm. If you go 30 seconds faster, like, do not waste that effort, because if you're starting to touch threshold just a little bit, you won't really experience the effects of that till later in the event, but you will. And I think this study gives a little bit more of a in the field basis for that type of finding.
But I also think it informs training too, because every once in a while in a race, you have to fuck around. Definitely. And find out, and like, you have to push yourself. But I feel like if you're not having training intensity distributions in your actual training sessions, where sometimes you like touch the stove and do things like VO2 hills,
yeah,
I think it then becomes really hard for the body to come back and to actually rally off of that.
So let's do some takeaways, because mm-hmm. one thing that's interesting on fatigue resistance for me is that often I think coaches are the ones that are trying to solve this problem. And then researchers are trying to then like essentially backfill about why anything even works. And so we have a lot of data. We've been measuring fatigue resistance before it was even called durability. So let's break down like four different ways that we think about improving this.
Yeah, actually, I think the first place I'm going to start, I'm curious if this is where you're going to start too, is fueling.
Yes.
Because it's like, actually, whenever we see cyclists talk about this, like in order to actually have a period of time where you spent training and then go and do a test on tired legs, like the fueling that you've done in that prior training block matters so much.
Yeah.
And I feel like if an athlete's not pushing 60, 75, 80, 90 grams of carbs per hour,
yeah,
even measuring fatigue resistance, like you're just not even measuring the same thing.
You're just measuring the fueling skill.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Fatigue resistance can only be measured if someone fuels fully.
What do you think is there a minimal level in which like carbs per hour in which you're fueling sufficiently to actually be able to measure fatigue resistance?
I think 60.
That was going to be my guess too.
But yeah. I prefer 75. Mm-hmm. Until then, I'm just like, well, we're just measuring your ability to take in calories and we should focus on that first. And you know, the thing that I see is that athletes, you need to practice this. You need to actually be performing well on tired legs to perform well on tired legs. So it's less of like an individual skill than a developed skill mm-hmm. that applies with genetics. And so actually the study is really interesting in that regard, is that each data point was totally different. So it's hard to draw cross-population conclusions because every single one could be determined as fatigue resistant, semi-resistant, not resistant. And if you're one of the not resistant people, chances are you just need to practice. And yeah, there's probably some genetic underpinning, but you can improve from where you are. I mean, I've seen that. I used to be one of the worst measured professional athletes on the team. And now I'm amongst the top 75%, you know, and it gives me a lot of confidence.
Okay. Your point about the different distributions of athlete data points was an epidemiology mic drop.
Oh.
And your sexiness just went up many, many, many levels. It was already there.
Yeah. Epidemiology and Dune. That's my personality now.
The two definitely have high correlation. How do you actually practice? So we talk about, you just said something about like running on tired legs.
Yeah.
Do you do that? So I think there's many different ways to do that. You can do that either across days or within a session. What is your favorite way to structure that?
Okay. Well, that's going to get to my number two.
Oh, shit.
Nervous system activation mm-hmm. is yeah. what I think this is about. So in the course of training, you get plenty of aerobic volume. But I do think it is important sometimes after 90 minutes or 2 hours to get the type of stimulus that stresses your body in a similar way of like high intensity or races. So the way I do it, like to do it sometimes that you don't, is hill strides or something like that. But there's other options.
And the reason I don't like doing that actually is I think that hill strides are often a biomechanical injury risk yeah. after 2 hours of running. And so for me, I would much rather do that in the form of tempo.
Yeah. And tempo works great too.
Yeah. It's actually one of the few areas that we disagree yeah. as coaches. Yeah.
Another way that I've been piloting for myself that really works well. And I've had athletes that showed me this over the years, and then it led me to incorporating it a little bit more, is after your run, just hop on the uphill treadmill mm-hmm. right after.
Yeah.
So you're getting that stimulus right after, or doing your strength work, your mountain legs, your step ups right after. So essentially recruiting the muscle fibers after you've had this type of work gives you stimulus to help it, even in small ways. Like, it doesn't need to be hard workouts. It can be as simple as pushing an uphill or ending a little bit faster or doing some hill strides or hopping on the uphill treadmill.
And I also even see like a bigger time delay impact on that too. It's like you can do back-to-backs as well. So like for me the other weekend, I did a 100-mile bike ride. Yeah. And then the next day I ran 20 miles. And honestly, the feeling of running 20 miles after a 100-mile bike ride felt very much like what exists after doing like, you know, 2 hours of running and then trying to run hard.
Yeah,
so you can do it in like back-to-backs too.
Occasionally existing in the fatigue resistance space is helpful. And then number three is aerobic fitness above all else. At the end of the day, this has something to do with glycolytic factors. And so what does that rely on? Your mitochondria, your lactate shuttling, even if it's low intensity, even if you're doing a 200 miler, that's probably going to be what helps you perform in those settings. So raise that aerobic volume up as much as you can in the context of things like cross training. Like, it doesn't need to be running miles, essentially.
And it's kind of fun to think about all these different things and layer to them together. But I also think there's like a psychological impact of all of this too, is that when you've been in a state in which like sometimes you're running on tired legs, yeah, or you're existing in a place of more fatigue and you're pushing through, the brain almost just remembers it on race day.
Definitely,
too. And that's,
yeah,
actually, I almost even like doing some of this in the 14 days leading into a race, because it's almost like the brain remembers it just as much as the body does too.
Yeah. And finally, raise the ceiling. Like, that becomes incredibly important for all of these different elements. Like, we're probably not going to get to the talk about improving climbing, but even in extended efforts or anything like that, what ends up mattering is your power output at VO2 max. Mm-hmm. And the reason is not because of VO2 max. It's because that ends up determining your power profile curve everywhere else. So with running, they're talking about critical power in 15 seconds and things like that. For running, the same metric would be your output, your climbing ability at VO2, which relies on things like hill strides, short intervals, stuff like that. That's still going to be determinative for your performance as you fatigue. All right, the next one is a really fun study that's more of a scientific anomaly, I think, and just a curiosity than an actual training thing.
Okay, and it involves vibrations.
Yeah.
And I think it's really fun when like scientific anomalies and curiosity have a Venn diagram overlap with vibrations, and my brain starts to dream real big. Like, how could I vibrate everything?
Yeah, and this one is actually from 2018, and I didn't go and search all of the subsequent literature after it. I just found this in one of my rabbit holes. So yeah, this is something I like to do, is like, you might've done this on Wikipedia. Like, for example, I'll click on Battle of the Bulge just to like learn like a guy. And then eventually I'll find myself thinking about, I don't know, Justin Bieber or something, going down the Wikipedia rabbit hole, just clicking on different things.
Okay. Also stay tuned. This is how earlier, or what we're about to get to, I got from boobs to gonads to Oliver Sacks.
Okay.
Yes. It's really fun. I feel like the greatest joy in life is just following random rabbit holes in terms of train of thought.
Yeah. So I did that with the scientific studies. It was just clicking on reference, and wound up at this one called Adding Vibration to High Intensity Intervals Increases Time at High Oxygen Uptake in Well-Trained Cyclists.
Okay. But I was a little sad because I love the like underpinnings of this study, but it was out in 2018 and I'm like, where's the tech?
Yeah.
We haven't really done anything yet with this study.
Well,
that's
been a
whole
my question.
6 years. Yeah.
Have we, and we're just not aware. Like, this could be the type of tech that is behind the scenes a little bit more, or is being applied in different types of products that haven't hit mainstream so much. Like, people have tried to sell us like things that vibrate in your brain, like your, like things like that.
Which, oh yeah, but that's totally different than vibrating your vastus lateralis, which is in your quad.
Yeah, I don't know though. My point being, there might be tech out there that we're just not aware of.
That's true.
Because it feels a little bit hacky, as we're going to get to. So there were 10 cyclists with a VO2 max of 78, so very high athletes, like very, very good. And they did 6 by 5 minutes at the highest power possible with 2.5 minutes recovery. As always, I love these quotes from studies. It says, they received strong verbal encouragement given to ensure maximal effort.
I know. I always want to make you as the like postdoc in there, just yelling at people in your all caps, like enthusiastic tone. It would be amazing.
And then what they found is that there was higher output and sustained high heart rate in the vibration group, which this involved 40 hertz vibration. And this difference was substantial. It was called a lot at one point within the study, which I've never seen before. It was mind-blowingly larger.
And then it was nice too, because so in addition to those findings, they also looked at what was happening within the muscles, which I think is really important too. It's like, you want to have some sort of like biological plausibility reason for why this is happening. And what they found was that the group that received the vibration actually had much larger average EMG activity within the vastus lateralis muscle, which is a component of the quadricep muscle. And so it was great that they were actually able to measure this. Okay. So the theory is that when you apply vibration, and they were doing so through a force plate on the ground, which I believe the bike was sitting on.
I think under the rear wheel.
Yeah. Which honestly, I would like, think about how good that would feel. I'm like, can we just have that for pleasure?
Can we just put a bike on top of the dryer?
Yeah. Or vibrator. That's what I was.
It need to be a big vibrator.
I know. Can you imagine training adherence if you just stuck a vibrator on top of a bike?
Well, what is, you know, a water bottle cage other than a convenient vibrator holder?
That's true.
Just really big vibrator.
That's true. I know. They need to make them even bigger.
You're about to get a pack, Megan. What are the two front pockets in a pack other than two dildos? Right there.
That's true. Right there.
Perfect.
I know. That's what I'm going to think about when at the Canyon Sunder Kay.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyways, the theory is that they think that the vibration impacts muscle spindles. So muscle spindles are essentially like sensory receptors that are located within the muscle. And then when they like respond to vibration, they send signals up to the spinal cord. And then the spinal cord then sends excitatory signals back to the motor neurons to cause increased activation in the muscles. And so the theory is that they're doing this exercise, and when they have vibrations, the muscles are like activating more and responding more essentially to the VO2 or like to the workout impact.
And that's so interesting because there must be some other opportunities to put this into practice other than having vibrators everywhere. Like muscle spindle activation, that's relevant in things like downhill running, let's say. Like when we talk about delayed onset muscle soreness, the nerve endings within muscle spindles are part of what causes your legs to get really sore after you did downhills for the first time. So is there some connection there? Can we just have like a Theragun at an aid station and get some of these benefits of activating some of the nerve endings?
Actually, I was thinking you just send a Theragun to someone existing in Florida without a vert and be like, prepare these quads for eccentric muscle contractions. I don't think it's as
maybe
easy
less
as that.
I'm thinking more like aid station and performance. Like you often see these vibrating massage guns within races at aid stations. People will use them on their legs. Maybe they're seeing some similar factor of causation that the study might have been looking into.
Well, actually, there was another hypothesis. So the, like one hypothesis is that it's muscle spindle based. And then there's another hypothesis actually, which I think you're going to love, is that the vibration actually induces additional opening of the blood vessels within the leg, which then actually favors blood lactate elimination better. And so there's like kind of these competing theories as to like whether the vibration is actually allowing athletes to clear lactate faster.
So interesting.
Or whether it's a mechanism of actually working on the muscles or a combination of both.
Well, and the studies on the vibration guns will show that athletes have improved lactate clearance in days subsequent to a hard session. So maybe it's somewhat similar there. Maybe there's something weird with vibration and how the body like incorporates cellular signals and things that isn't fully understood. Like I feel like there's something here that needs to be a piece of tech.
Also, there's something here, and this has been repeated in multiple studies. So what I love about this study is that they did it in, these are like high profile cyclists, and you expect that they have grabbed like the 1% in training. But they've also done like repetitive studies on like more recreational athletes or athletes with all different types of backgrounds and seen similar findings too.
They're bringing vibrators to the people.
I know, to all the people. Make them available to the masses.
The feed. Step up. Get some of those things. But final thing on this that I thought was really interesting is I was surprised by these findings, obviously. That's why we're talking about it. But I wanted to Google and see if this was replicated. So I went and Googled 40 hertz vibration study, thinking I would just get this study and maybe some ones that came up off after it.
Okay, but 40 hertz is like the magic number in vibrators.
Yeah. So the first thing that comes up is a 2013 study on Alzheimer's pathology in mouse models that found that 40 hertz vibration for these mice improved, you know, Alzheimer outcomes and things like that. And then there's tons of different studies, not just in Alzheimer's, but Parkinson's and things like that, involving how this incorporates with brainwave operation. And so not an area I understand at all, but it does point out that there might be some very interesting avenues for the future that maybe in 20 years, we're thinking about these vibration models in a more serious way that's applied, you know, more universally, not just in athletes, but in other situations too.
And sticking these models on Elena the robot and seeing what happens to robot brains as we apply 40 hertz frequency. I would love to know.
So in 20 years, it's just going to be robots?
I know. We're going to go from like, instead of going from like mouse models to human models, which actually we've done. So they are starting to do some like phase 3 trials in humans in terms of Alzheimer's and like 40 hertz vibration.
Yeah.
But then it's going to be like mouse model, human model, robot model.
The future we can all believe in.
Yeah. Okay. But actually last question as it relates to muscles. So one of the theories is that as you increase in hertz, and so as you increase like the frequency of the vibrations, that you start to recruit more fast twitch muscle fibers, which probably would not be ideal for endurance athletes. And so I'm really curious to see too, like how like, I mean, I feel like there almost needs to be like personalized vibration frequencies.
That would be a step up. It feels weird to me that it would recruit muscle fibers differentially that much, just based on the like, you know, structure of muscle fibers. I'm not sure of the mechanism there. So I'm going to take the researchers at their word for it, but I'm a little skeptical of that distinction.
Are you skeptical of vibration in general?
No, I mean, you know,
I guess the question is like, how would you use it? So cycling, it makes sense. You stick like, you know, a vibration plate beneath a wheel and you have more of that impact, or you just ride on like, I wonder if riding on like cobblestones or washboards has a similar thing.
I think we're delving into this too far.
I know. This I'm is thinking just a cool way study. Too much about vibrations. I guess it's when you're riding on washboards, it's like very far from 40 hertz. Vibrations.
I do think everyone should have a massage gun.
Yeah.
I think that that's the simplest way to use it. Using it, you know, before and after your activity goes a long way. And it's essentially like having home massage. The studies on it are pretty fantastic. And so I'm sold on that piece of tech. I don't know where else it goes from here.
Okay, do what I feel like I could see you doing.
What?
I'd be on the treadmill and you're so committed to like my fitness and my mitochondria and my lactate clearing that I'd be running and just be holding a massage gun to my leg as I'm, because it's like much harder to apply it in like the actual running sense.
I imagine you could put it under a treadmill. You could do something with a force plate in a treadmill.
Oh, cool.
So
I imagine it'd be good for bone density too.
Yeah. And definitely add some fun to that uphill double.
I know. My motivation to train would be much higher. I would not have days like Saturday crying on the couch. I'd be like, take me to my treadmill.
You're not taking that chair. Okay. Let's go on to news and fun things. As always, we just break down a bunch of things that caught our eye this week. Very first thing was from Patreon, actually. It was on athlete contracts, and it was a comment that was on the main episode where we broke down contracts a few weeks ago and how we think about this. And here was the comment from someone that's really in the know. They really understand the sport. They said, I think the athlete contract amounts you mentioned are way too high. Can you imagine how many shoes a brand would have to sell to offer $100,000 to an athlete?
It's a great question. Yeah. But I guess also my counterpoint too is that I don't think athletes, I mean, it's really hard to be a pro athlete living on a contract of $20,000 a year. Yeah. Like you need other jobs probably to sustain that existence. And I feel like it almost gets back to a humanity and storytelling element as much as it does. It's like, let's just treat athletes like good people and allow them to reach their full potential. I guess that's my argument.
Well,
what's your argument?
I think we have to ground it in the business end of it, which is that essentially in the modern era, we don't have ways to reach mass consumers in anything. Like marketing is a different world. It's why the feed, the SWAT podcast is presented by the feed nowadays. Like the feed is looking for different ways to reach all of the people that will want to use the feed. So that's clear. Podcasts, Instagram influencers, things like that. Athletes in that framework are the new broadcasting on ABC. And companies realize that. But I think athletes are a little bit behind in advocating for themselves. That they think they have the answer to this listener is the correct one to think about. How many shoes can I sell? And then that determines my worth. And it's like, no, actually, you're helping the brand tell a story about itself via your own story. And so athletes are storytellers. So here's my response to that comment. How many basketball shoes does a company need to sell to offer $5 million to an athlete? Or an influencer who gets paid $100,000 per Instagram story? These people are getting paid because of how they generate brand value rather than direct sales. Similarly, that is how trails will change in the coming years. Lululemon definitely spent more money than they'll directly earn back at the further event. But their bet is that the brand capital will pay off many times over. Athletes are storytellers, not salespeople.
Okay, that is, I love that. That's a great point. It's also kind of funny because I feel like this is the point I argued for Lululemon further. And remember our discussion and you were like, well, how is this going to sell in like the Lululemon C-suite?
Well, of course, my question though, my response to that is less about the, our understanding of it and the people that greenlit the project. Like they don't think they're going to sell this many shoes. That's not how they sold it. It's a question of as priorities change within a company, does that actually move the needle?
Does storytelling and narrative telling
Do they think that type of storytelling justifies whatever amount of red you have to put onto your account balance sheet?
And I guess I think it does. And I guess my
I do too.
I absolutely think it does. But I also wonder too if that is almost a privilege of larger companies.
Yeah.
Like you can afford to be in the red more than, you know, a smaller company who almost can't necessarily take that.
But I guess my point is if you just view it in a narrow band. So my question is, is Lululemon does that. So are they saying that this, the part of the company that sells trail running shoes or running shoes or whatever is this self-contained thing. And we're not counting total sales and revenue and everything that goes into the balance sheet, determines EBITDA, all that good stuff. And if we're not determining that, then yes, that might be in the red because of some of these expenditures. Similarly for, you know, a shoe company, if we're measuring the value of an investment based on how many people use the discount code, that is going to require pretty low investments unless someone has a massive reach. And then we're just going to be having influencers be professionals. But instead, if you zoom out large enough to think, okay, what's the total revenue of the company? How much does that depend on the overall marketing influx? Like Geico, for example, they're not thinking that their commercials are selling car insurance. They're thinking that their commercials will make it so when you need car insurance, you think of Geico.
After you've heard it 15 different times.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, yeah.
Similarly, I think that's how athletes need to sell themselves. It's like, I add to your story. Mm-hmm. And as a result, like I understand what the economics of your company are. And I can make myself a indispensable within that economic framework. So if you're negotiating with Nike, you should not be undercutting yourself. If you're negotiating with a small brand, then maybe it's a lot different because then you're thinking about the whole balance sheet.
But I also think it should almost be this sigh of relief as an athlete, because sometimes I've seen the worst mental health crises come just after an athlete has signed a big pro deal contract.
True, yeah.
Because all of a sudden now there's this pressure on themselves to exert in performance. But I do feel like we're existing in this world where it's not just performance, it's the storytelling element and piece to that. And I hope it gives athletes almost this like insurance on signing a large deal is it's about like the much larger narrative of who they are as a person and a human.
And your story includes bad days.
Yes.
It includes, you know, crying on the couch. It's not just the glorious crossing a finish line. I don't know what that actually does anymore. What does happen though is sharing yourself authentically. That's valuable. And find things that align with those values.
I was gonna say, if a brand doesn't align with those values, you probably don't want to run for them for 3 years anyways.
And it goes for every job or anytime you're advocating for yourself. Like, you know, if you're working for a big corporation, ask for more. Like, you're more valuable than that. Okay, let's move on. Number two, I actually really like this one. Lil Nas X of Old Town Road fame ran the New York City half, and he did it in high top shoes.
It was so impressive. Also, high top shoes that look like they've been around the block several times.
Thousands of miles, it looked like.
Yeah, but maybe it was genius. Maybe he would have like sprained an ankle in a pothole without it.
Yeah.
Actually, I saw the high tops, and my ankles have been better recently, but I saw it and I was like, maybe I just need to run in high tops. Maybe I would stop spraining my ankles.
Yeah, maybe that's actually it. Why aren't there trail shoes? I mean, I guess
they do make trail shoe high tops, and they honestly feel not comfortable.
Do they work?
I don't think so.
I feel like people would just break their leg if they wore high tops.
I know,
rather than their ankle.
Yeah, so you break your knee. Or your femur. It's like a horse.
So we are doing a 50K this coming weekend. Mm-hmm. Are you going to tape your ankles for that?
I will. Actually, okay. I tape them lightly. So I do like, sometimes I call it like single bagging it, double bagging it, triple bagging it. I'll do like a light ankle tape. But you know what I've actually found the biggest thing to be?
What?
Just paying attention.
Just paying attention.
Yeah. Sometimes like I would go like check the heart rate on my watch and be like, bang.
Yeah. Okay.
Ankle bang. Or I'd like grab something in my pack. And so I just really need to like limit my outside movement and just focus on the trail.
Just focus.
Yeah. Well, have you found any difference for your ankles?
Honestly, I haven't been on trails enough to test them this year because of all the little things I've had going on. So
yeah.
I don't know. It's going to be some of the first trails I've seen, first genuine trails I've seen in a little bit.
Yeah. And I think for me, just getting further and further away from breastfeeding, my ankles were like little lax, little babies. And now like, they're starting to firm up.
And maybe I was getting sympathy laxity in my ankles. Something was happening. Okay. Number three, Nico Young set the NCAA record in the 10K. He ran a 26:52 10K.
As a debut. Isn't that bananas? He's in college and he stepped up. So the Sound Running put on something called the 10, which is a 10K. I really like the branding they have. It's the most I've heard of the word 10 for the last year at least.
Yeah, it is clean, but you know what could be cleaner?
What?
Take out the just 10.
Just 10. I like
Justin Timberlake.
Look at your Silicon Valley. You're like optimizing their culture.
You know what's better than a million people running PRs? A billion people running PRs. I was pretty blown away by that. I think the game is definitely changing in US running in general. I mean, the times were so fast. I mean, how much do you think is the super spikes and how much is just thinking about training theory?
I mean, I think a lot of it is training. I mean, I actually wonder though, if it's almost like a feedback cycle. It's like people are running faster times and then we think about training theory more and then people, because of the super shoes. And so I feel like it almost all fits into this like Venn diagram flow chart in a perfect way.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've been curious to see Track All Access, which is putting out all these workouts now. It's a great YouTube channel. Go check it out.
But you never want to watch them at night.
Of course not.
Yeah.
No.
I always want to watch them before bed and you're like, Megan, no.
It's like, let's put this vibrating force plate under our bed and then go to sleep. It's like the same type of idea. It's too activating.
Actually, instead, we've been watching music videos every night. And I think this is why I'm just like vibing with songs. It's been really fun to sit there at night and just have a series of music videos with you.
We were doing country music videos last week.
Yeah, they all follow the same parameter.
Yeah.
You were saying, and I totally agree with this hot take, that it should be like this guy falling in love with the girl and taking her down to the lake.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the girl becomes a man. And how much would that like transform country music, a gay country song?
Well, no, I think there probably are gay country songs, just not the ones that
not popular ones.
That were on our YouTube algorithm. But
have you heard a gay country song?
Well, what I think I have, but they just don't say it. The example that I was thinking of is he's like, I want a girl who works on her truck.
It's like, no, you want a man.
Goes down to the lake. And I was like, and then it was showing a picture of her working on her truck. And meanwhile, he's at the bar with all of his friends. I was like, dude, look to your left, look to your right. You got the opportunities right there.
They're sitting right
like,
next to you.
People can be whatever they want to be, but like if you're framing gender in that construct, maybe think outside of your binary.
I know. And some of it is really obvious. He's like, I want her to have a long fire hose. I'm like, yo, we got fire hoses all around you.
I want her to like Dune and professional wrestling. Okay, next up. Should we do Mateo Jorgensen or skip that one?
Let's do it.
Okay, interesting. So this is on the cycling discussion. So Mateo Jorgensen, American, just won the Paris-Nice stage race. Huge deal. It not only was it against top competition, but historically, Americans in the last 10 years have not done that great at this since the maybe doping era of cycling that was really prominent went down. But the reason I wanted to mention it that I thought was really interesting is the very first thing in the cycling like Twitter sphere that people went to is started talking about his body weight and how negative that must be for athletes in that sport. I feel so bad for cyclists.
Yeah. How do you think, I mean, it is this really hard existence because cycling is like physics.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't be because it's like, that's not the best thing for like healthy long-term running. How do you think cyclists like push back against that?
Well, I think it's all about power output. And yeah. It needs to come down to that. Same with running, like finding your strong is key. There's just as many stories of cyclists getting really strong and gaining weight and performing at the top level. But the problem becomes that so much of cycling training theory stems back from dopers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all of these bird boned athletes from the past, like were very obviously doping. And I don't want to put names on specific people, but there's a team in Great Britain that was very clearly doping their athletes. And no one likes to say it. They were talking about marginal gains and stuff at the time. And it's like they made it seem that cyclists should look and act and feel a certain way. And it's affected how everyone thinks about the sport now. And so I think cycling has a long way to go to kind of scrub that mentality and even farther than running. So if you're a cyclist out there listening to this, which we have a bunch of people that are not runners listening to this that are cyclists, message us and we will talk to you about the science because it is so important to fuel your body to find your strong.
Yeah, find your power. And I actually think that oftentimes cyclists don't always love doing strength training. And I actually think strength training is integral to bike power as well. And so I think like part of finding your strong is putting out watts in the gym too. And I think it helps a ton.
Okay. You mentioned strength training. We should probably do a little bit more discussion on this, but I've started to come around, Megan.
You've come around.
I think squats.
Do you disagree with yourself?
Oh yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Well, I know. So I do like, I do think that you shouldn't be carrying around soreness from your strength training. I don't think strength training should take a lot of your time or be a huge stress, but since we got the squat rack, I have found that like overall, I've felt a little bit better and my performance has been better after I adapted to that. So like yesterday I did 3x10 reps on the squat rack in the context of the normal strength I do. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting a little bit stronger. It's reflected in my heart rate. It's also really reflected in my cycling, as you mentioned. So I think we might need to update some of the SWAT strength principles.
I'm excited.
Squats.
We should actually have a more robust strength training plan that we update.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
We'll see.
Let's make a video.
We'll see.
I'm really excited.
Oh, okay. No, because that would have my form.
Yeah. Your form's great.
My squat form? I don't know. It's
I think
tough.
It's great.
Yeah.
I'm How's looking my in the form?
Your form is great. Sure.
I don't know.
Sure.
I think my butt goes down way more than it does. We've talked about this.
Yeah. But we have a mirror right in front of the squat rack. And all I remember is like, I can't now be in front of the mirror because whenever I look up, I just see like every vein popping out of my neck.
That's a good thing.
Lifting like no weight. Just like, and I'm like, that's not a good look. I can't be in front of a mirror.
The mirror helps me a ton. I almost feel like it's like doing a run and not uploading it to Strava.
Okay.
Is doing squats without seeing it in a mirror.
Wait, do you?
It's like my brain needs the visual neurons to know that I actually did something.
Do your veins and things pop out when you do it?
I don't actually look at that.
Okay.
I look at how low my butt is. Oh, yeah. You're over there looking at your veins. I'm looking at my ass.
You focus on the peach.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. But can I add a cycling hot take? Actually, I feel like we've been talking a lot about biking on this episode is I feel like so often runners are like, oh, biking is this like amazing savior of a sport because you can't get injured. Like running, there's so many like overuse injuries and pounding based injuries. But you know what? On cycling, you crash. And Mateo Jorgensen had a bike crash, I think it's like back in 2018.
Yeah.
And do you know what happened?
What?
The disc brake rotor like shredded his calf.
Oh my God.
So can like, you imagine that? How terrible that is?
Yeah, I imagine. And so I paused for a second.
Yeah. And like really actively thought about that. And it made me feel a little bit better about the context of running injuries is like, yeah, like maybe running, you know, maybe doing a 20-mile long run might like erode away a tibia at times, but you're not like sending a disc brake rotor through your calf.
We'll leave listeners with that visual that you didn't need to tell them just because.
But just like appreciate the context of running. Okay, it's great. Yeah, yeah. You don't have like crashes at 60 miles an hour.
I guess a tibial stress fracture is better than a impalement. Half muscle. Yeah. Okay, here's actually an interesting quote. This is from Lance Armstrong.
More cycling. Yes.
Yeah, more cycling. I'm impressed with this generation of cyclists. In many ways, they are more talented, but they do not compete like we did. Hugs and high fives, this would have been totally foreign to me.
That's such a Lance quote.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't give Lance a hug because like he probably has a syringe poking out of him. Maybe you test positive if you give Lance a hug.
Yeah. You know, it's weird. Maybe I'm just like, it's like some Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah.
But I like Lance.
I do too. I mean, he is who he is.
I've forgiven him for whatever he's done.
You're so kind.
No, it's not that. It's more just like, I don't know. I just feel like he did play a big role in my growth and stuff. But I do think that this is the weird part where I'm like, Lance, I want to root for you. Don't lean into like the toxic masculinity part of sports that is not necessary and actually tears people down. So he's saying that hugs and high fives are foreign. And meanwhile, the new generation, they're more talented. It's like, maybe you should connect those two dots and say,
yeah, actually,
they're performing better partially because they're not so ego-driven and focused on themselves. Like maybe this is actually a massive opportunity that hugs and high fives are the new PEDs.
That's so true. And I feel like it's the only way to sustain yourself in sport. Like, yeah. Honestly, I feel like if you root for anything other than hugs and high fives of the competitors around you, for the most part, it's like the biggest thing that's going to give is like not giving yourself a self hug in that process.
Yeah.
If that even makes any sense.
Oh, for sure. And that's maybe the lesson here is for everybody. If you're going to do a race, root for everybody around you.
Yeah.
Root for them to have their best day. And if it's better than your best day, great. It just makes racing and everything so much more fun.
Also, it's just like, it makes life so much more fun. I used to be like a fierce competitor and I'd be like, you know, maybe not like a disc break rotor for someone's calf, but like, you know,
metaphorically,
like something of this, like a 1/100th percent vein in one of my competitors.
Yeah.
And now it's like, I've reached a much, like, honestly, I love all the people I race against.
How did you do that?
I think just like the shell of time.
Yeah.
Crying on the couch enough. Yeah. Going through enough shit. And it's just like, you know, it truly doesn't matter. And I think also too, like once I started doing it, I realized how much better. It just took so much energy and was exhausting to like wish disc brake rotors on people that, you know, it was much better without it.
I love it. It's so good. But it's such a good lesson for everybody. All right. Next up, I wanted to mention the website Deadspin folded for good. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because Deadspin used to be my favorite website. It's a large form of my own voice comes from writers on that site when I started reading it back in the mid-2000s. And, you know, all through then until they went through this long process where it got their overarching Gizmodo Media Group got bought by, or Gawker Media Group got bought by private equity, told the writers that they had to change their voice and stick to sports. They said, stick to sports. And then the writers did a week of just writing whatever they wanted on non-sports, and then they all quit en masse, ended up forming Defector, which is my favorite sports site now. So it kind of carried that reins. But it was kind of poetic justice. The reason bringing it up now is that Deadspin, the husk, the ghost of this old website, finally, you know, laid everybody off essentially and said that we're going out of business. And to me, it's a good reminder that the voice is what leads the day. And, you know, Deadspin, as soon as they made the decision to stick to sports, they lost their soul and they were always going to lose out because what people gravitate toward is your soul, your voice, the very unique things about you that might be weird and certainly don't pass for conventional in a C-suite.
And I think it's so fun to just embrace that like eccentricity and be like, this is weird. This is the cool part. And I don't know. I feel like we've both done that over time. And I love your eccentric writing voice. And I also love too that you have prioritized that for yourself. And I think using Deadspin as an example and like making sure you lead with that, like with love and lead with eccentricity and like not just writing about running. And I think it's so cool.
Yeah. But I mean, it's, who knows if it's going to pay off. Like right now, all my writing's on Patreon.
Yeah.
And why I always bring this up is to me what the Defector writers did, where they all quit when it was clear that they were no longer valued for who they were, is one of the most courageous things I've ever seen. Because it's like, they're writers. They don't have these opportunities. Defector took like a year to launch after that. And in the meantime, they're just trying to make ends meet. But they decided that their principles mattered more to them than the, you know, the the maintenance of a job that was going to like totally destroy their voice. So be protective of your voice. It matters.
Yeah. I love that so much. Can we get on to Oliver Sacks now? Speaking of voice and speaking of weirdness and eccentricity.
One more thing.
Okay. One more thing for Oliver Sacks. Yeah.
Which is that last week we mentioned Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
And did a big thing piece on that and got a great message in from Patreon that I wanted to read. Saturday Night Live used to be better than it is now because when we think about the past, we are remembering the greatest hits from those eras. And when we watch now, we miss all of the forgotten filler. So no matter how the actual, or when we watch now, we see the forgotten filler rather than missing the old one. So no matter how the actual quality fluctuates, the past will seem better even if the show is in an upswing.
What a mic drop. Also, that is like the perfect application for running.
Yeah, that's
do you ever
why
look back and you're just like, oh my gosh, like the days of like training and racing always seem so bright and sparkly.
Yeah.
And I feel like that has to do with just how we reflect on anything.
Yeah. And the point is we remember the greatest hits.
Yeah.
Always. And so it's easy to think that right now.
Well, right now is the greatest hits.
Yeah, exactly.
By nature of being right now and by nature of us all going an inch closer to death.
Yeah.
Like an inch closer to the brake rotor.
Yeah. So remember SNL. It's like SNL is better now than it's ever been. We just don't remember all the forgotten filler. So same in your training. Like always don't like anchor in the past because your best is your very best day. And that's going to be what ends up defining this period for you anyway. Okay, so to get on to Oliver Sacks, should we start with the sports bra follow-up to lead into
it? Let's do it all.
Okay, actually. Let's do it all.
Yeah, because I think this also shows a pattern of thought of our weirdnesses of how we start at sports bras and get to Oliver Sacks. But I think that's actually very relevant reference points. Do you want me to read this one and then you read the next one?
Perfect. So as context, a few weeks ago, we mentioned a sports bra study that found that tight straps can actually impair breathing and hurt running economy.
And it's pretty wild because the sports bra has been out, I think, for 47 years. I think it was 1977 that it came out.
Yeah.
And it's like the first performance-based sports bra study, which kind of blows my mind. But here is a listener comment in response to that. Megan and David, although I've never met you, I feel like we're best friends because I've been listening to your podcast for a couple of months now. Thank you for your uplifting spirits and powerful energy. After listening to your recent discussion on sports bra tightness and breathing patterns, I had to conduct an experiment of my own. On and off for at least the past year, I've had occasional feelings of being unable to take a deep breath, almost as though my diaphragm was being constricted. After learning about the study on sports bras, I put on one of my super old, stretched out, and definitely not high impact sports bras. I went for a run of my boobs being more bouncy than usual, but also with this new feeling of lightness around my chest. Mm. This run felt great. So great that I decided to do a 1 mile time trial, which I hadn't done in a long time. My time was faster than I'd expected, and I finished feeling as though I could keep going instead of feeling like I could no longer breathe and needed to slow down. Up until now, I have always purchased running bras that were tight enough to prevent any breast movement. It seemed like that's what society and other runners told me was the right answer. So thank you for talking about boobs and helping to solve my strange breathing problems. I'm now on a quest to find the perfect sports bra for my body, one that simultaneously has a large enough band for my wide ribcage and strong lats, and enough support to prevent a boob strain. Here's to hoping I find that magical, perfect sports bra to enhance my running game. I love you both.
This listener is so cool. The big thing that jumps out to me there is boob strain.
Yeah.
Not something I was aware of as a man.
It definitely happens.
Good to know.
Yeah. Actually, here is my hot take is that I think there's not enough personalized approach on sports bras. I feel like when athletes go in for a mammogram, they should come out with their reward with a 3D printed sports bra.
Whoa.
I know. That is a super hot take.
Yeah. 3D printing seems like an application that would make a lot of sense for sports bras.
Especially too, mammograms are like jarring and tough. And I feel like you should go in and come out with a souvenir.
Huh.
I know.
This is really good.
Yeah. Have you ever wondered how I'm going to do a mammogram? My boobs are so small, I don't even know if they fit in the machine. They'd be like, they're good. There's nothing even there. Have you seen that the machines, they just like suck them, but there's like nothing to suck.
I haven't seen machines. I uplift everything.
You're like, I'm speechless.
Don't know how to respond to that. I think it's going to be perfect.
Great.
It's going to be great. It's going to work out so well. So that's a reminder to everyone. Pay attention to this type of thing.
Yes.
Don't have a strap that's too tight. Find what's comfortable for you.
Bras are performance related objects, and I think invest in them.
Just like running shoes. Like you wouldn't wear an uncomfortable running shoe or a shoe that's not dialed in for you. You should try on, get this process going on and avoid boob strains.
Yeah. Also, it was a study done by Shalaya Kip, who's an Olympian. And basically the premise of the study was like 1.3 to sometimes up to 2% change in running economy from a proper fitting sports bra. And it's like, that can be minutes in a marathon. It's a lot.
I think it's okay to say. I heard for a little bit that Shalaya is just, it's interesting to her that the one study that gets all this mainstream coverage
is the sports bra.
Is the sports bra.
And she's done
study.
Like tons of studies.
And her studies are amazing. We've talked about some of them on the podcast, but it's kind of interesting to think about science that the mechanistic type of science often doesn't get covered. And then if you do something that just has a little bit more of availability bias.
Yes.
All of a sudden, everyone's like, just, oh, I'm into that.
Just toss a vibrator into all assignments and see what happens. Be like, 40 hertz everywhere. Couldn't done there.
Okay, so what that leads to is what Megan talked about with Oliver Sacks's partner. That's the roundabout way we're going to get to this.
Okay, so you're going to get to what the partner was talking about. And then I'm going to follow up because reading this, so I've always loved Oliver Sacks, and I had no idea he was in a relationship with Bill Hayes.
Yeah.
And it is one, their relationship is, instead of doing podcast research yesterday, which I did do eventually, but for like 45 minutes, I read about their relationship and their love story. And it was so beautiful that I want to end our podcast talking about that.
Oh, so what do you want to say about the
relationship? Oh, you go first and then I'll
follow. Okay. So the reason that we're talking about this is that when we talked about bras the last time, I made jokes about, well, you know, about guys and all of that stuff. But there's actually really interesting evolutionary thinking on, you know, male gonads and bouncing and stuff like that. That what's his name? Hayes?
Bill Hayes.
Bill Hayes, his partner, wrote about so beautifully and eloquently as he was navigating into running after Oliver died.
Okay, so anyways, I read this in the podcast outline and I was like, this is beautiful writing. I want to read more about Bill Hayes. And that's how I went down the rabbit hole. But why don't you read this first? And I really appreciate this writing style.
Okay, so here it is. All of this raises a question. Can one actually run a race without athletic support? I had to find out for myself. My partner, Oliver Sacks, the late neurologist, that's what led us down the rabbit hole, had a home in the country on a large piece of land. The driveway alone was a quarter of a mile long, perfect for putting my question to the test. One day, I shucked shorts, underwear, and my shirt. I kept my shoes on, the supposed advantages of barefoot running notwithstanding, and took off. There was some jostling down below, some definite, what's the right word, bouncing, but within seconds, my testicles retracted and scrotum followed, as if shrink-wrapping my balls, the two now vacuum-packed within the lower abdomen. My penis contracted to a fraction of its normal size. It was as if a message had been sent to the nervous system by wire. Pack it up quickly, boys. I found myself sporting nature's own jockstrap. I ran to the end of the drive and turned around. The sun warmed my whole body and into my insides. I ran my hands over my skin and slopped up the sweat, a manual strigil. Jogging had passed the test, but what about sprinting? I did a 100-yard dash back to the top of the drive, unbothered by the slight flopping. If anything, I found it comical how my genitals now resembled a bell, a very small bell. Beyond this, what I felt deeply was something vital, wild, powerful, more hunted than hunter. I felt, in a word, like an animal. I turned and sprinted back down the drive as fast as I could.
Isn't that a fantastic piece of writing? Also, I love how you read that.
I mean, this is such great writing.
And it was such good writing.
It's just fun to think about like the wildness of running.
The primal nature of running. Yeah. And I feel like what I love about running is like sometimes it's heinous, but that primal nature is so attractive. Like it's just like, it's the coolest thing. And like something like running up a driveway, which is not even far, can elicit that.
I like that you said attractive right after we talked about shrink wrap balls. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think that I always try to tune into that is that when we say a stride, you're doing something so fucking primal. I think maybe the like every part of running doesn't feel that way. But when you get this opportunity, think of every little bit of honing your physiology as something that we're programmed to do in an evolutionary sense that is just empowering as hell. And that's one reason I love the writing. It just connected me with that. Like what drew me to running in the first place? Like why do I test myself to see what this bones and gristle and balls can do? You know, it's because of that.
Okay. So now we're going to go from balls to a love story because this is where my brain traveled in doing podcast research.
Uh-huh.
So Oliver Sacks read Bill Hayes' writing and loved it probably as much as I did and wrote him a letter.
Oh.
And they started having written email correspondence back to each other. I think it was sometime around 2008.
Yeah.
And in their written correspondence, they fell in love with each other. And Oliver Sacks was in his 70s when this happened. And this is what Bill Hayes wrote about this. And I was reading this on Sunday and I was just like, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. I learned that Oliver had not only never been in a relationship, but he'd also never publicly come out as a gay man. But in a way, he had no reason to do so. He hadn't had sex in 3.5 decades, he told me. At first, I did not believe him. Such a monk-like existence, devoted solely to work, reading, writing, thinking, seemed at once awe-inspiring and inconceivable. He was without a doubt the most unusual person I'd ever known. And before long, I found myself not just falling in love with O, it was something more, something I had never experienced before. I adored him. And then he goes on and talks about, so he and Oliver then developed this relationship, this like long-term relationship. And Oliver was in his 70s when this happened. Wow. And can you imagine like being in your 70s and not having had sex for 35 years, as yeah. Bill Hayes recounts, and like just building into like a budding relationship. And it really makes me think about like the prime of life is really whenever.
Yeah. Yeah, whenever. I mean, I haven't actually read the next quote you put in this outline.
Yeah.
Do you mind reading it? Because I haven't, this is me hearing this for the first time. And I loved that first part. I want to hear the rest.
So then Bill goes on to recount kind of like their love story and what he learned from Oliver. And he said, I think there are several legacies of Oliver. I think he opened up the world for all of us with conversations about neurodiversity and neurological conditions and how people adapt to them, everything from autism to Tourette syndrome to blindness. I think he also left an amazing legacy in his writing about mortal illness and facing death in his columns in the New York Times. That was, I think, a very generous and gracious act in his final year. And his final legacy is that while on one level, my book is about me reinventing myself in middle age, there's another story there about Oliver Sacks reinventing himself in the 70s. And I love that. At age 75, he opened his heart up and fell in love, started a new romantic and domestic life with another person, with me, and continued to work so productively, all of which made being old seem adventurous and fun. Isn't that just like to fall in love with like, you know, and to like come out of the closet in your 70s as a public figure. And Oliver unfortunately went on. He passed away from an aggressive form of cancer that came back.
Yeah.
And to do that and to live it so openly. And Bill Hayes actually went on to write a book about it called Insomniac City, which I just ordered and I'm very excited about. I just think it's the coolest thing.
That's such a great story. Thank you for bringing it. I didn't know you were going to talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I love, crying. I was like obsessed with Oliver Sacks.
Yeah, same.
And you had got me the book Music Ophelia. And I don't think I ever knew actually about like his story and his relationship and how that evolved through life. And I just think it's also kind of fun too. Like aging is sometimes scary to think about, but you can have a freaking wild time in your 70s.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. She gets crazy.
It gets real.
I'm yes. so excited. Cannot wait. All right. Do you want to go on to hot takes and secrets?
Let's do hot takes and secrets.
Okay, perfect. So let's start with this one. Hello again. Hope this isn't too off limits for the pod, but during a recovery run today, I was thinking Strava needs to add a period adjusted pace. PAP. As a female athlete with PCOS, I know I should be happy that I've got a pretty regular period. However, I'm still annoyed at the audacity of my uterus. To calculate PAP, the user must enter symptoms on a sliding scale, including cramps. Does it feel like a donkey just kicked you in the gut? GI distress. Are you about to crap your pants? Etc.
I love this. It's yeah. so true, actually. Like, I feel like whether it's like the first few days of the period or like heading into the period, for like for me, the luteal phase, the last part, it's almost always the hardest in terms of how yeah. it impacts my performance. We definitely need this on Strava.
You know what the biggest upset is?
What?
Crying on the couch was not during your late luteal phase.
I know. It's kind of sad. I have nothing to blame it on. I was yeah, like, yeah, this yeah. is just me and my existence. Yeah, yeah.
That's you at the best part of your cycle.
I know.
That's
I know.
Your peak performance, Megan.
I was like, this is me at my best. Okay. But I think instead of PAP, which reminds me of pap smear, which can sometimes be like a jarring experience for yeah. people, we should just call it WAP.
WAP?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. You know, because it's like the same thing.
It is
and
wet.
So it is wet.
Wet.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I'm like, we just need to reclaim the period as WAP. During this period of time.
Okay, yeah. Yes.
WAP adjusted pace. WAP adjusted.
We're going to end there. That's so good.
Also, this is definitely not TMI. I love that we just talked about what we did and then came into this. I feel like nothing is TMI for us.
Nothing is TMI.
Yeah. Anytime an athlete sends that to me over text, I'm like, just wait what I've
said. Yeah, I'm like, do you understand us at all? Okay, so if you like the podcast and the lack of TMI, go wherever you listen and give it 5 stars. Click follow, especially on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out, helps other people find it. It's so fun to do this for you all. And that's a good way to just get some background. Doesn't require anything. You can support the pod.
Well, I love that you did that after all the conversations we just had. We filtered out all the people.
Yeah, yeah. We filtered
out. If they're here now, yeah. they're really here for it.
The 1-star reviews.
Have been gone.
They've been gone long, long ago. Have you noticed how I do it at the end now, not the beginning?
Yeah.
It's for a reason. It's for a very good reason. Okay, before Listener Corner, a quick promo for John G.
Oh, I love John G.
So we got a great message from a listener, which is this. By the way, I bought some John G gear using the swap code last fall. Somehow, the shorts got a small hole in them. I reached out to customer service, and they were so nice about everything, and they are sending me a replacement. You picked an awesome partner. Since then, I've ordered more gear from them and will continue to do so.
I just love John G so much. I also yeah. love how they're like bright and loud and like all of their colors are so fun. Actually, when I was at the Lululemon Project, they gave us like khaki clothes to wear yeah. in the desert, but I got mine very dirty within a period of about 12 hours. So I wore John G for the rest of the trip and it was like coral and khaki. And then I was just like bright green, bright orange, bright pink. And
how did Lulu feel about that?
No one said anything.
No one said anything. Yeah,
I feel like they probably wanted to, but I really love my Jonji. They're great.
They understood that we're just too connected. So go to jonji.com. You can use code SWAP or just join their Jonji collective. You get 15% off. That's the best way you can do it. Tell them we sent you if you buy anything, but mainly it's just to support the company.
Also, they just do great stuff for the environment and for people in general. And just like, I love businesses that have just a holistic look on the world of like, let's make the world a better place.
Definitely. Okay, let's go into listener corner. This one is so inspiring. I want to take a minute to say thank you both for encouraging people to shoot their shot and take risks. I had a road half this past weekend. I was hoping for 135. My PR when I was 26 was 135, like 134.54. I'm 43 now, so I thought, hey, I can do that. I had a pre-race call with my coach, and she told me she thought I could go 130 to 131 based off training and numbers hidden workouts. We decided I should fucking full send. If it goes poorly, I'll be okay. And hey, it may go great. She had belief, and so I figured, fuck it. I do too. So race day rolls around and I just took a shot. I ran a 128 and felt controlled and fairly comfy the whole time. I fueled like a boss, taking in more fluid and gels than I would have in the past. I'm so proud of myself for taking a chance and believing, and so lucky I had a coach who fostered that belief. I also wore my SWAP crop and hat for extra swag and luck. Thanks for all the content and vibes. Shooters motherfucking shoot.
That is a huge PR. That's wow. So exciting. And at 43, I'm just like, that's incredible. Actually, we see a number of athletes hit big PRs in their 40s.
Yeah. And whoever, send in who your coach is.
I know. Actually, I was thinking about the same thing. I was like, good job, coach.
So we can give
high
a promo
five,
to the coach.
Yes. Yeah.
That coach needs to get out there if they need any athletes. Because that's exactly what I think coaches do, is it give you permission to understand that you're capable of more than you might think. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's like the biggest thing about training that I love exploring myself. It's like, in abstract, everything I do in life, I pretty much doubt myself until I do the thing. And athletics has given me a chance to explore what happens if you do just believe and shoot that shot and fail a ton. And in failing a ton, learn that it's okay. And then eventually succeed beyond your wildest dreams, even if those successes only happen 1 in 10 times. So the reason you shoot is not because you're going to run a 128. The reason you shoot is because now you're the type of person that's going to try to run the equivalent of 128 in everything else you do in life.
Oh, it's so cool. And I'm really excited to see who this coach is. And I think for us as coaches too, it's like we often try to layer just like honest discussions right in alongside that belief, so that when an athlete hears that belief, they know it's coming from like a place of reality of like, yeah, you can run at 128, you can run at 130.
So speaking of, we're going to do a 50K this week. We're going to be down at Crown King Scramble.
Yes.
In
very excited to race.
Say hi to us. But how do you think it's going to go? Where are you at with your thoughts on this? Because we haven't talked about it yet in the pod.
Yeah. I'm in a good, like, I feel like actually training's been progressing really well. I don't think I'm at my like fully capable self yet. Like, I was actually reflecting. I was like, postpartum heart and hamstring surgery is kind of what I'm coming back from, which is a pretty large
first ultra
trifecta
for a long time.
I think so. And I'm excited to stand on a starting line of a ultra and be comfortable not being my like full self yet. But I do think things are like growing and evolving, and I can see it. And I'm really excited about that.
You're gonna absolutely crush.
How about with you?
I'm more thinking about you. I'm only going because you're going, and I'm like, they don't allow crew, so I might as well race. Put that uphill treadmill to the test in this uphill race. But you're so ready. And I wanted to end because like, I do think that, you know, in the context of training and the nitty gritty comparison to the old SNL episodes of your own journey, you're sometimes not fully able to see just how much of a beast you are.
Oh, thank you.
And so like, I'm so excited for this, not because you're going to crush it, but because I want to see you on a start line of an ultra with that fire in your eyes, knowing that like, yes, it makes you a little bit scared. And that's when you've always thrived, is when you're really scared and you're just like, fuck it, I'm jumping.
Yeah.
So let's go jump.
Jumping sounds... Are we jumping or are we like dancing out there?
Oh, are we jumping? Yeah.
Yeah. Or are we vibrating? Maybe we're vibrating through this whole 50K.
Let's vibrate.
I know. Let's do that. That's way better than jumping.
Team vibration activate.
I'm so excited.
But first. Huzzah.
That was so good.
We love you.